Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Hebe v. Lehrkamp for the appellant. Hebe is Mr. Gregory Eastland, an attorney from Rapid City, who will do the opening 20 minutes. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
And then Mr. Ken Duell, who will do the rebuttal. All right. Also from Rapid City. And for the appellee, Lehrkamp, is Mr. John Stanton Dorsey, attorney from Rapid City, correct? Very well. Mr. Eastland, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. We're here today because of the grant of summary judgment to the defendant, Mr. Lehrkamp. Mr. Lehrkamp is a police officer in Sturgis, South Dakota. What we're here to decide is to whether or not there are genuine issues of material fact which should go in front of a jury rather than summary judgment. The standard for the court here is that they do an independent review of the record in this particular instance. In the answer, the defendant admitted a number of the allegations, and for whatever reason, when the memorandum opinion came out, some of the things that the defendant had admitted as really uncontroverted became findings of fact against us. And what we're saying here is we're entitled to a jury trial and that the findings of fact be put in front of a jury. We set out the facts in quite detail to the court, but I'd like to highlight the facts because I think we need to in this instance. It started on December 9th, 1998, when some kids decided to skip school. An 11-year-old boy, a 12-year-old girl, and a 13-year-old girl. They skipped school and then came back just as school was being let out at 3:30 in the afternoon, and they made up a story as to where they had been. And the girls told a classmate that they had been abducted and raped. She told her mother, the classmate told her mother, the mother then called the police. And that's when this whole scenario took wings, because Officer Lehrkamp then came in to investigate. Officer Lehrkamp's an experienced policeman, and this was it was a sensational crime in Sturgis that these girls had been abducted. They came up with a story where they implicated two young men. They didn't know the name of one of the young men, but had seen him. He lived a few blocks from where they were. The young man, which is Todd Hebe, did not know these girls. They had evidently noticed him, but he had not noticed them. And they gave descriptions. They gave conflicting descriptions. What Mr. Lehrkamp did that particular night, and he thought he was onto something very big into this situation, was he started talking to these girls, getting the story. He kept them together, but even with them together, they started giving conflicting stories. They were upset. They asked to go home. He let them go home. And that evening, rather than separate them and visit with them about these stories that they came up with, and then kind of incredibly, they came the next day with a statement that they had put out and put together of what happened. What he had here was a new prosecutor who was fresh out of school, had been there for 2 months, and was there for domestic crimes and also sexual crimes. She relied upon Mr. Lehrkamp to gather the information. And right from the start, the story started falling apart. These girls said they had been abducted from 7:30 in the morning till 3:30 in the afternoon and had been driven around. They said they had been raped in a house at the VA on the VA grounds. Later, Actually, it's within hours, about 24 hours. They say that, no, this happened in a car. They gave different descriptions of Mr. Heeb. One said that he was wearing a black shirt. Another girl said he was wearing a white shirt. Also, Mr. Heeb had an alibi. He was at work that day. He had checked into work mid-morning, worked at UBC, lumber supply, had gone to the doctor, actually gone to the doctor twice. He was getting fitted for contact lenses. So he had certain breaks, but he checked in, checked out. Officer Anderson was also looking at this and doing some investigating. He came to Lear Camp and he said, it looks like we might have the wrong boy. We better look elsewhere. But Lear Camp thought that he had something here to go on and ignored the anything that was exculpatory on it. It's somewhat incredible how he made his arrest. He went over there and talked to him, pulled out his traffic citation book and wrote down kidnapping, two counts, and gave that to him and arrested him. No warrant. At that time, there were conflicting statements, an alibi, and no physical evidence that a rape had ever occurred.
What about the Woods positive test from the hospital?
They had a test there, they said, for some type of a foreign substance, but there's no semen at all. It never, they marked it down as inconclusive. But as far as there having been some type of a rape, there never was any semen involved in this.
What does the Woods positive test mean then? What is that? It measures some kind of substance.
The only part that I know of there, they said there was an unidentified foreign substance. And, Your Honor, I do not know, and I don't know that that was ever identified, what kind of a foreign substance there was, but it was not semen.
Well, then the next step, as I understand, what the doctor on one of the cases said probable sexual assault.
It did say, one of the doctors did say a probable assault. You know, it'd be questionable at that time as to whether or not a crime had been committed to begin with on that part of it. But going to the next step as to whether or not this particular person had committed a crime when the identification was not there, and even giving the benefit of the doubt that there was anything medically to run with in this case, with the alibi and the misidentification and the changing stories as to whether or not something had happened, this did not lend itself to probable cause. The arrest was made and imprisonment. He was questioned quite severely, and which I think would probably be expected in this type of a case anyway. But he went back to his alibi, both of being with a friend, sort of a mentor, a fellow that he worked for, who had a security company, who was very well respected in the community. He'd been with him, had breakfast with him before work, then gone on to work, then gone to the doctor's office. In spite of that, he was put in jail. When we take a look at probable cause, we look to the facts and the circumstances within the officer's knowledge, and we look to the case of State versus Mack or the case of State versus Stutt. And so we look to the facts and circumstances within the officer's knowledge of which he with which whether or not it is reasonably trustworthy information. In this case, these particular girls and the young boy, stories changed every time that they came in there. They weren't being questioned by anybody but a police officer. At this time, they were only being questioned by Lear Camp.
Well, this sounds like an ongoing investigation. Are you alleging that he had just dropped the ball and said, Watts, I've done enough work here, we're going to proceed and prosecute?
No. Once he got into the case, once they had arrested this young man, he kept on investigating. The arrest takes place on December 11th. And on December 18th, Learcamp himself goes out to check on the alibi. He had already been told by Officer Anderson that the alibi looked like it was good, but it had been a fairly cursory examination of it. But on the 18th, Officer Learcamp went to UBC. Two of the people there said, yes, he checked in, identified him as having worked there during that day. He went to the doctor's office. The doctor and three of the doctor's personnel said yes, that Mr. Heeb had been there that particular day. So that gave them really almost all of the hours. Then you take Bob Roush, who was the security person, and he said, yes, we went to coffee at McDonald's. Then they were also identified by other people who were at McDonald's that were there.
Was there any testimony by the girls or the three complainants that that the defendant was gone from time to time, was gone five times during the day, or, you know, that he was there sometime but not otherwise?
The initial story was that he was there all of the time. And this is where it gets worse as the case goes on. Learcamp goes and talks to the girls afterwards and says, after he sees that the alibi is, it's foolproof, or at least there's people there, very credible people that are not interested or say he's there. And then he starts with the girls about, could one of the men have left? Could he have been here? Could he have been there during this period of time? Could he have left at one time and been gone for, 20 minutes, an hour? When the girls decide this, but now we're down into December, quite a ways into December, then the girls start changing their story, absolutely contrary to their original story, and said, well, maybe he did leave part of the time, where we're kind of confused. And so that came up, but it came in later. It was well after the arrest that Learcamp starts to try and get involved in preparing the prosecution of this case and working with the girls as far as changing their testimony.
A question about the summary judgment. The facts as you present them, there really isn't a dispute that the girls changed their story and all of the information that you've been telling us. So wouldn't we have to look at it and, as a matter of law, determine that there wasn't, that this wasn't reasonable for the officer to have acted in the way he did?
I think as we went back and forth, when you take a look at this case, the facts actually are in dispute. When you take a look at what the defendant has talked about the facts, the defendant talks about them changing the story, but, it's just slightly, it was believable, it's still sort of staying on the same story, and they keep that going on, and so there is a dispute in the facts. If you take a look, the defendant used the major part of their entire brief in this case arguing different factual matters in there. Yes, they are disputing the facts. We think they're really quite clear, but the defendant has come in here and has argued about the facts.
But it doesn't matter if there's a dispute about the facts, because for summary judgment purposes, the trial court judge is supposed to determine the facts based on he's supposed to take the facts in the light most favorable to the defendant.
That's correct.
And so how do you turn it into a court trial and decided on the facts that not only are there disputed facts, but the disputed facts favor the state when that's your scope of review?
If I'm following the court on that part of it, I believe on our set of facts, we're entitled to present those to the jury, and it's a jury question as to whether or not there was a probable cause. And the court did not take the facts most favorable to us.
The court, is it a matter of taking existing facts and inferences, or is there a dispute about what the story actually was? Let me phrase it a different way. The fact that the defendant emphasizes certain facts and you emphasize different facts doesn't mean there's a dispute about any particular fact, does it? I mean, it's just that You're focused on certain facts. They're focused on other facts.
Okay.
As Justice Meyer Henry said, is there really a dispute about, you know, that the victim on this day told this story, and the next day a different story? And you emphasize certain of them, they emphasize others. But the facts are the facts. I mean, they're, isn't that the situation here?
Yes, but I mean, the court found, here's a couple of findings in the court's memorandum. On page 2, the court found that these children were raped on the campus of the Veterans Administration, which is contrary to their statements. On page 3, he says, all the children described the incident the same. That's in the memorandum opinion by the court. They didn't. These children did not describe the incident the same. I mean, it's flat out wrong, and that's what the court's opinion is. That's what we want to present to a jury, is these girls, and the boy too, did not describe the incident the same. They're very differently. There was no probable cause to go forward in this case. And that finding by the court, which the defendant urged in their brief, is absolutely contrary to the facts that we have. I mean, if you're going to believe the defendant, a jury could come up with one, you know, if they could say, yes, these kids were all the same. They had this argument, or they had this story down pat, and it was very believable. If you're going with what we have and what we can show to a jury, it is absolutely that these children did not describe this incident the same, and a reasonable person doing a reasonable investigation would not have had probable cause, and this young man should not have been arrested and should not have been incarcerated. So I don't know how the facts got convoluted to the part where there's a memorandum opinion that all the children's described the incident the same, but it's flat out not true.
But we can look in the record and see what the facts are. We can yes. see these contradictions, and we're entitled to, because this is a de novo review, isn't
yes.
it? Yes. I want to go back to your comment about the probable cause. Now, I understood the law to say, modern law, to say that a determination of probable cause is a legal question. Don't we at least have to make some threshold legal determination about the probable cause that decision that the officer made?
If there are not disputed facts in this instance, it would be for the court's determination as to whether or not there is probable cause. But there's authority, and we've put it out in our brief, that in the civil side, when we get into one of these civil cases like this, it becomes a jury issue as to whether or not there was probable cause for the arrest. And that's when there are facts that are disputed facts in there. We're not talking about something where there are undisputed facts. Like I said, these girls' stories did conflict severely, contrary to the opinion of the court.
Mr. Eastland, to follow up on that, are you suggesting that the cases are different for civil and criminal cases? In other words, it's pretty well established the question of probable cause in the criminal context is reviewed de novo.
Yes.
Yeah, but are you suggesting that the cases in civil cases are different?
I'm suggesting that in a civil matter where we have this, if you look just right into the Jones case, I believe it's the Wolford case, also when they talk about that, it's the fact finder in the civil part will determine whether or not the officer had probable cause. Correctly, the court will correctly instruct them on what is probable cause. Was there probable cause to go ahead and arrest this person and incarcerate him? But I believe that's really well established, Your Honor.
But can you, in a criminal case, can you even get to the question of probable cause if there are either disputed facts or genuine issues of material fact when you're supposed to take the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Heeb?
Yeah, the non-moving party. What we're saying in this case is the court did not take the facts. In
the court got to probable cause before he ever determined that there were genuine issues of material
fact. Right. And that's what happened in this case. But we're entitled to have the fact finder in this civil case come in and determine whether or not there was probable cause.
There wasn't any warring experts giving opinions on probable cause and on good faith or bad faith of the officer and things like that.
We had our expert, which obviously never got to testify, but put in our report, and it's in our brief too. Our expert talked about, and he trains policemen, and came in here that there was not probable cause. There was no expert on Learcamp's side. So we had the only expert, and the only expert was saying this did not amount to probable cause as to how you instruct an officer to make a lawful arrest.
Your time has expired.
My time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Eastland. Mr. Dorsey, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Well, of course, the danger of calling an expert, vitiates what a court does. The reason we're discussing all these facts, the reason that these facts are all, that the story's changed, the reason that we've all agreed to that, is that the standard on a review of probable cause is a totality of the circumstances. Okay? That's the criminal standard. And probable cause, going back to Darrell v. Schumacher, we're not talking about constitutional probable cause. It's whether or not this officer had the objective, reasonable belief that a crime was committed and that Mr. Heap committed it. Now,
but how is that any different than the criminal case?
Well, Darrell v. Schumacher talks, and it goes back to the Treadway case, and it goes back a long time. It says it doesn't talk about constitutional probable cause. But I don't know if it's a distinction with a difference, yeah. Justice, because when you read, for example, when you read the Eighth Circuit cases on the civil rights violations of whether warrantless arrests were under probable cause, you find, generally speaking, that the determination of probable cause does not turn on whether, these victims' accounts were specifically accurate and all consistent on all fours from the time of the arrest throughout the entire time of this investigation, which was ongoing, but rather whether he was objectively reasonable. In other words, it's not probable cause in fact, it's arguable probable cause. Is there arguable probable cause in this officer based on objective findings? That's why we have these disputes of when they say, well, there's no physical evidence. Well, before the arrest, these girls submit to rape examinations at Rapid City Regional Hospital with professional nurses trained in this, doctors who say it's probable and likely to have occurred. That's the communication that's going to this officer. And as time progresses, things change. Stories change. That is not unusual in these cases. But what begs the question, why didn't we have this determination in the criminal side? There wasn't a writ of habeas corpus filed. It could have been done, couldn't it? It could apply to the Supreme Court of South Dakota. It could apply to the Circuit Court of South Dakota pre-trial. And although there are exceptional circumstances that writs are granted, he could have got out. That wasn't done. Motion for bond didn't happen until March. So, it begs the question that Judge Johnson's decision was formulated based upon the fact that if there's not probable cause, the false arrest case goes away. If there's not probable cause, the malicious prosecution case goes away. Malicious prosecution requires both malice and probable cause. We're not here to talk about malice today, just probable cause.
Well, why isn't that a jury question then? You said it's objective, reasonable belief. Why isn't that a jury question?
Because it's a question for the court in the first instance. It's a legal question. That's what the cases cited, McElreevy, Schlitz Law, that's what the cases hold. And in fact, if we're allowed to upset these kinds of determinations by hiring an expert like Mr. Gilbert, we'll have experts running into court supporting writs for habeas corpus.
Well, you know, I'm a little baffled why we have experts in this type of case anyway. I mean, if it's a question on whether it's a medical issue, bring the doctor in. We're lawyers. Why do we need an expert to tell us what probable cause is?
Well, and the judge determines it. And in this case, after a couple days after this event, let's not forget that the grand jury met. Okay? Now, there's been no suggestion in this record that Mr. Learcamp lied to the grand jury, fabricated a tale, entered into a conspiracy with these three young people. Now, the case is about tipping over grand jury determinations of probable cause.
There's innuendo, though, at least innuendo, that he presented to the grand jury what favored probable cause and left out everything that did not favor probable cause.
Sure, and that's why in the press and in the community and good criminal defense lawyers argue that you can indict ham sandwiches.
Okay.
But the point is, Your Honor, but I think, if I may, the point is that the fact that we have these disputes, it's not up to the prosecutor to put on this evidence of exculpatory evidence. And I think that a fair reading of that transcript and the grand jury proceedings, and let's not forget that they changed and evolved over time. Even after he was released, there was another grand jury proceeding in May, on May 22nd, and two of the girls, the brother and sister, the Grusings, still said that something happened out there. They still said it. Nicole Wilde changed her story repeatedly. But there still was suggestions, even as late as May 22nd, that the Grusings that something still had happened out there.
But there's no dispute about whether or not he had probable cause to determine whether a crime had been committed, but it's this defendant being charged with it. Isn't that the issue?
Well, it's the warrantless arrest. It's the warrantless arrest. And then I think we have to divorce ourselves from the arrest itself and then the continued incarceration. I think after the grand jury speaks, we've got probable cause.
Well, I question that a little bit. In other words, if he puts a spin on the evidence and only produces such evidence that will support probable cause to the grand jury, then the grand jury's decision of probable cause is somewhat tainted. Then that goes to the court, and there's a court case. If it had happened that way, but then it's later dismissed, then it comes back to the court on a summary judgment motion, and at that point we have the spin and the non-spin, or we have facts both that favor probable cause and facts that favor a determination of non-probable cause. And if those things are in dispute, if there's genuine issues of material fact, if you go ahead and decide probable cause, you're jumping the gun, because you shouldn't make that decision. That's for a fact finder to determine.
Well, and here's how I respond, I guess. Judge Johnson had before him all of this information, all of the conflicting reports. It was there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this would have been no different than presenting a drawn out a type of probable cause hearing, preliminary hearing, where the court determines probable cause.
Excuse the interruption, but that's the case in almost every summary judgment that we reverse, is that the judge had all this stuff before him and then he went and made a decision. But if we say summary judgment was improper, if there were genuine issues of material fact, he erred in making a decision without regard to the merits of it.
And I understand, but he was right. He was right when he said that the existence of conflicting witness statements does not itself create a question of fact. It doesn't. I mean, we've got these disputed facts, but it doesn't necessarily.
It may or may not, but that's a jury question. That's not for summary judgment.
Well, I beg to differ. Justice, I think that in the first instance, the question of probable cause is for the court. In a criminal case, and in a civil review of whether or not there was false imprisonment. If you go back to Darrell v. Schumacher, it clarifies that it does not depend on the actual state of the case in point of fact, but upon the honest and reasonable belief of the party. The want of probable cause is essential. The probable cause which will justify an arrest need not be constitutional probable cause. Rather, it is sufficient if the facts would lead a reasonable person to believe a crime has been committed, regardless of whether the party is later found innocent.
How do you figure, how does the, you know, when we look at a summary judgment, we usually say we take the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. How does that fit in this case then? How do we use that portion of the test?
Well, I think that when you go back to Illinois v. Gates and the Beck v. Ohio, the United States Supreme Court cases, which has been followed by this case, by this court, and warrantless arrest cases, you still have to look to the totality of the circumstances. You can assume everything that they say is true. You can assume that everything that Mr. Heeb says is true.
Which is the alibi with? You'd have to assume is true the alibi.
I got to assume the alibi is true. But then you also have to consider the totality of these facts, which was that as time evolved, it wasn't like Sleedslaw versus McElreevy, where this trooper just dropped the ball for 8 days and didn't do anything. I mean, this officer did what we want officers in South Dakota to do. He looked at stuff. He made applications for search warrants, which, by the way, were granted by Judge Moses. As time went on, got the car, got the fiber, did the searches. They spent, as you can tell by the record, an exhaustive amount of time looking into this. The probable cause determination, if I may, Your Honor, is that they have to look at the totality of the circumstances. Assuming everything they say is true, that's fine. That's why we're talking about all these conflicts. That's fine. But it's first a matter for the court to determine whether or not it's an objective, reasonable officer out there. Would an objective, reasonable officer have considered this person to have committed a crime? Based upon the reports of these girls, the findings of the hospital, that Heeb, you know, how does Heeb explain the fact that he knew that this had happened and when it had happened, when that information hadn't been released? We can talk about the fact that he wasn't the guy, that he was the wrong guy. But we can't look at this in hindsight. We cannot put their assumptions of fact and their and the courts accepting everything he says is true in a retroactive view, a hindsight type of view. I think it's your duty, de novo, to determine whether or not Officer Larecamp was looking at these facts objectively and reasonably as time went on.
Okay, when we do that, should we be, on any particular fact, should we be, let's take the alibi for instance.
Sure.
Should we be saying to ourselves when we analyze this that the alibi is true, or should we be saying there was strong evidence of alibi in this case?
You should look at it just like it happened, in its temporal context, in its chronological context, which was, this man says he's got an alibi. Officer Anderson, the co-worker with Larecamp. Larecamp's in charge. Anderson goes out. Record says, boy, this guy might have an alibi. Words to that effect. We better go check it out. They check it out. The window of time, as the testimony changes, the window of time changes, as is often the case in investigations. One need only look at this particular case and see how they were trying to sort things out. Well, what about that early morning hour? They checked with Bob Roush. They did all those things, Your Honor. And they still found out that, well, it's so many miles out to the Fort Meade where this allegedly occurred, this rape, and it's so many miles back, I guess that's enough time where this could have been committed. And you'll find that Officer Anderson really wasn't enamored with Bob Roush in terms of his credibility or reliability. These are gut reactions by cops in the field. This is what we ask them to do. Okay? but it didn't stop there. Okay? It doesn't stop there. You can look at that alibi. You know, I don't think you have to accept it anything other than for what it was and how it came out and what they discovered as time went on. Did the alibi get shaken? Sure it did, according to these officers. Were they objectively reasonable in determining that? Absolutely. Why? Because they had all of these other facts that they're sifting out. We're not allowed to determine in reviews of probable cause whether or not these selective facts create a genuine issue such that it goes to the jury. In a civil case, false arrest, false imprisonment, malicious prosecution, the civil Supreme Court holdings on these cases talk about reviewing them in the context of whether there was arguable probable cause on behalf of these people. No different than the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals when they look, I think, like in Myers v. Morris, some of the other cases I've cited, it's not probable cause in fact, but arguable probable cause.
If I understand your argument, you're saying that we, the Supreme Court, should determine probable cause on the totality of the circumstances.
Yes.
All right. If we were to do that, if you're right on that, then in fact what you're asking us to do, to step into the shoes of a jury, of a fact finder in this case, and make determinations that they never got to make because the judge took it away from them on summary judgment.
No.
Yes.
Well,
why not? Why aren't you asking us to do what the jury didn't get a chance to do?
Because these determinations and the review of these determinations are, you know, if you want to set that precedent that these types of cases can be reviewed, I think you're walking a very slippery slope. You'll have arguments like this being made that what the grand jury determined didn't mean anything. What prosecutors did in terms of retaining continuing to prosecute the case not meaning anything, suggesting that you might as well wait until this sorts out before exercising your writ of habeas corpus. I mean, that's another way to figure it out. Probable. I hear what you're saying. Totality of the circumstances is the standard for probable cause in the criminal cases that we've reviewed all the way up through the Supreme Court of the United States. Is that still the standard in a civil case? Yes, I think it is.
Tell me why it's not for the fact finder in the first instance. Tell me why it's not for the jury to make that decision. And why is it proper for this trial court judge to take it away from him and not give him a chance to decide?
Because magistrates and trial court judges do it every day, or grand juries do it every day in South Dakota and across the United States. You are usurping the function of a magistrate who hears it in a preliminary hearing. You are usurping the function of the grand jury, you know, and we don't need to belabor the history of the grand jury.
Well, this is not the question that they decided. This is the question as to whether or not this officer really had probable cause to proceed to what he did. I'm not usurping, or I'm not suggesting usurping the magistrate court or the circuit court judge. I think the circuit court judge usurped the right of the jury to make this determination based on the totality of the circumstances.
Okay. Well, then you have to go back and overrule McElreevy and all the other cases that say that it's the legal question in the first instance.
Mr. Dorsey, I have a follow-up on that. Then under your argument, then just help me understand, when would it ever be a jury question?
Well, for example, if you had facts which suggested, unlike this case, that Detective Lehrkamp had an axe to grind against Mr. Heeb. Historically, Mr. Heeb had been in a lot of trouble in Sturgis, South Dakota, and Heeb perhaps had lost the ability or lost a couple cases that he had investigated against Heeb, and that he was out to get this guy. And when those girls came in and reported this, he was going to make an arrest, and he was going to make it stick, and he was going to do whatever he could to make that work. If we had facts like that, and then the case goes south on the prosecution like it did in this case, you might have something.
It would be a jury question as
a jury question. It'd be a jury question if you could show, like the Eighth Circuit cases talk about, for example, there's a case called Gora versus Hansen, 1989 case out of the Eighth Circuit. It talks about the pretextual cases, and that's an it's a civil rights case, but it talks about if the officer's arrest is merely a pretext to what has gone on here. Well, then they consider it under Harlow v. Fitzgerald and those cases. And interestingly enough, this case originally started in federal court. This our case, then they pulled it out. It was dismissed, and they dropped the 1983 action. Food for thought.
Your time is almost out. Tell me about the allegation that the court's opinion was wrong when the court described and made its decision based on the finding that the girls' stories were the same.
Well, if you read further on page 12 or 13, Judge Johnson acknowledged the existence of conflicting witness statements. I mean, I don't know if that's a... if you read the decision in its entirety, he acknowledges correctly that there were conflicting witness statements.
Thank you. Your time has expired, Mr. Dorsey.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Duell, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. With all due respect to Mr. Dorsey and his client's position, I believe that Judge Johnson did make the mistake that Justice Meyerhender was asking about earlier. When does a jury get to look at it? When the court's declaration of the facts can't be supported by the evidence in the field. That's exactly what we have here. This is not a case that the girls' stories changed. Learcamp changed their stories. If you look, as I know you will, at the case, they came in and said, the first thing they heard is that they were raped in a house at Fort Meade. Don't ever forget that. And then that they were raped in a car. One of the girls said, I was taken out of the car with my brother while the other girl was raped. And the other girl says, all five of us were in this little car and raped, and then we were kidnapped. The kidnapping continued till 3 or 3:30 when we were thrown out of the car. And we were with these men, and we drove around for 7 or 8 hours all day. And they yelled at us, and they screamed at us, and we were afraid, and we huddled in the back, and we cried. And they threw us out of the car and said, if you ever tell anybody, I'll kill you. For 7:30 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. That's their story. So you have to look at two prongs with probable cause. Was a crime committed? And was there a probable cause to believe the suspect in question committed that crime?
Based on the medical evidence, do you contest that there was probable cause the crime was committed?
I do, but not for that reason. I do because an objectively reasonable officer, under the totality of the circumstances, could not look at the three different stories that the kids told them and objectively determine that there's credibility to the stories that they provided, either to the events which were alleged to have occurred, or that Todd Heeb was the alleged perpetrator. So even if you give them the benefit of the doubt that a crime was committed, which I do not, and I don't think you should, but if you do, you still have the issue of Todd Heeb. And what is different about this case, and the Supreme Court has always said, you don't have a duty to go out and investigate an alibi. It's not your responsibility. Yours is to find probable cause. But what happened in this case is when, at the first instance, Todd Heeb said, I was here, 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 the day's over. And Detective Anderson went out and started that process. And when Detective Anderson turned to Learcamp and said, he's got an alibi, we need to do more investigation. And then when he testified in summary judgment down below, we have to do that before we arrest Todd Heeb, Learcamp ignored that. Learcamp chose to pick and choose off the tree of evidence what he wanted to create a pie of probable cause. This court should not condone that.
But it didn't end there. I mean, the information was furnished to a prosecutor and then to a grand jury. They believed it too, apparently.
Well, and Justice Sabres is correct. Mr. Dorsey is not. We do challenge the grand jury. You cannot candidly say that Detective Learcamp was honest, truthful, candid, and impartial in his reputation or representation of the grand jury. That's what you expect.
How did you? No, I don't understand. Did Learcamp make a presentation to the grand jury, or did the prosecutor put him on the stand and question him as usually is done?
This green young lawyer, her first case of any kind, put Mr. Learcamp on the stand, and as you read the transcript, she gave him the open door, what happened next, and he told a story. He told the jury, the grand jury, that the girls' stories were consistent, all three of the kids, that their description of the second assailant was consistent, and that the description of the clothes were consistent. And when there was a specific reference about an alibi, he says, yeah, we're looking into that, we'll get to that later. That's not being impartial, that's not being candid, that's not being truthful. Half-truths and deceptions are not what we ask of grand juries. Before a grand jury can make a valid declaration of probable cause and issue an indictment, we would expect that they have the totality of the circumstances to judge. Learcamp kept that from them, not the prosecutor, because she wasn't the investigator. When Learcamp told half-truths and deceived the grand jury, that's his responsibility. And this court should address that by saying that's not a valid grand jury indictment for purposes of protecting Deputy Learcamp from this action.
Mr. Duell, in your review of the law in this area, if this case had gone to a jury, were you able to ascertain cases from other jurisdictions as to whether or not the grand jury's indictment and the judge's issuance of a search warrant, whether those facts would have been admissible in evidence at a trial to tend to show probable cause?
I don't have those cases at hand, but I believe the answer is no. I do not think the search warrant might have, because it related to collateral evidence, but the issue of the grand jury indictment would not have been.
That's the general rule.
Yes, and I believe there are cases on that. I'd have to pull them out. But I don't think that would have gone. In the civil side, that would not have been presented, because it invades the province of the jury to decide, under the totality of the circumstances, would an objectively reasonable officer have found probable cause. And I don't ask you to do this as a Monday morning quarterback or with 20/20 hindsight. You lay each one of those elements out as they were being developed to Learcamp, and it's our challenge that you never rise to probable cause. Because as our expert says, with all due respect, Chief Justice, he says every time you lay down a piece of the evidence, you get further and further away from probable cause because they don't fit.
Mr. Duell, I've been in the legal profession now since 1975.
Sure.
Every year that has been involved in the criminal law. What does an expert need to tell me about probable cause?
I believe in a civil case where you have a jury of lay people, we're entitled to have that expert. I agree with you. I don't want to start bringing experts into criminal cases and magistrate hearings and preliminary hearings, but that's not our function. Our function is to create a clear understanding for a jury of the evidence that they will be presented with, and I believe that involves the criminology, the science of criminal investigation. So you and I may not need it, but a jury sitting there trying to decide if Detective Lear or Deputy Learcamp is an objectively reasonable officer, properly and partially evaluating all of the facts, I think that expert's appropriate. But what is troubling here is that once the alibi started or became clear that it was an issue, Learcamp ignored that. He ignored the fact that the photographic lineup, one of the girls refused to say if it was the man. Learcamp denies that there'd be a reason these kids would know each other. They live across the street from Todd Key. Detective Anderson knows that. Deputy Learcamp knows that because when he writes down the arrest ticket, he put down the address. It's across the street from these kids. Yet he ignores that in his analysis that two of the kids picked the perpetrator out. Then when he discovered, quite candidly, that Todd Heeb had a time-specific alibi, It's he, Learcamp, that goes back and starts tweaking the girls' and the little boys' statements. We can't have it this way. Don't you think you might have been in and out of the car? Don't you think he could have been gone for 10 or 15 minutes? That was not their story. That never was their story. Their story was they were picked up, kidnapped, taken to Fort Meade, raped, and held hostage all day. And Learcamp didn't like that because it didn't fit. It didn't fit the alibi that he had of Todd Heed. And it's appalling that in December 18th, when he finally gets around to reconfirming a lot of the alibi, he now decides that it doesn't affect the case because the doctor and the doctor staff and the employer at UBC, you know, maybe we can get this to be a shorter time period crime. And he doesn't report that. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't get into the court system. And then on January 14th, when the four boys come forward and say, the girls were with us all day. We drove around in a van, skipping school. And when John Grusing stood up and said, I lied, I put Todd Ebe into this, nothing happened. It stayed out of the court system until April, when they made the offer to Todd Ebe to plead to a misdemeanor or a felony in exchange for being released. And when he said, no, I did nothing, then it was dismissed. With all due respect, I believe that Deputy Learcamp needs to stand in front of a jury and explain those facts, which are divergent, conflicting, and justify to a jury and to a court supervising them, that objectively reasonable officer would have found probable cause. This is not the proper venue, summary judgment, for doing this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dill. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.